Welcome to Engage Arizona, Tim Gagline. Tim has dedicated his life and career to public service, from the Heritage Foundation to Special Assistant to President George W. Bush, to now his primary service as Vice President of External and Government Relations for Focus on the Family. Tim also serves as a board member for Family Policy Alliance, the network of state-based family policy councils in which Center for Arizona Policy associates. His primary focus has been to work to restore the biblical and moral principles that made our nation great. Toward that end, he's written a most useful and challenging book, quote, Toward a More Perfect Union, The Moral and Cultural Case for Teaching the Great American Story. Well, Tim, welcome to Engage Arizona.
It's great to be with you, Kathy, and a great honor. Thank you.
Well, thank you. So why did you write this book?
I love that question. I had a hallway conversation more than 15 years ago with my favorite historian, David McCullough. I had read to that point, I think, Kathy, everything he had ever written, but I had never met him in person. And I was part of a group of people at the White House to welcome him and to attend a talk he was going to give. And our friendship was all of 15 or 20 seconds old. And he said, I'm suffering from insomnia. I thought, what an unusual way to begin a friendship. He told me that he regularly met with members of the political class. He spoke at colleges and universities, loved the rising generation of young Americans, and was very deeply concerned about what he perceived to be cultural, historic, and constitutional illiteracy. He said, it keeps me up at night. And when I was doing research for this book, I had remembered that conversation. I found actually a quote from his doctor who said, David McCullough suffers from insomnia because of exactly the issue that I just shared with you. So I thought to myself, this is going to be interesting. I want to dive into the data, and I want to see what Americans, not just young Americans, but what do Americans know about the American story? What do they know about the American Revolution? What do they know about the Constitution? What do they know about the different chapters of American history? What do they know about our heroes and heroines? I'm an inveterate optimist, Kathy. I really am. Bottomless, unsinkable optimist. But I was rather stunned by what the data show. And so in the first third of Toward a More Perfect Union, I deal with data and I conclude that we're not on a road to historic or cultural or constitutional illiteracy. We're there. And I think that it has enormous ramifications for the future of liberty and freedom in our country.
What's very interesting is how you tie the data in the literacy challenge to the American crisis that we're experiencing today. So it's, you know, first, how do you define the American crisis and how is it tied to that lack of knowledge of history?
I love that question. You know, anecdotes are not statistics. And I'd like to share an anecdote, if I may, that I think illustrates the best answer to your question. So I was speaking at a major university about my book just a few weeks ago. And I spoke to seven different classes. And I would say, if you added the numbers together, about 1,500 students. And I said in each one of those seven classes, is there anyone here who's a native Californian or has spent a significant portion of your young life in California? There was a forest of hands that went up. I said to them, how many of you can tell me who Father Sarah is? Father Sarah's beautiful statue is in the United States Capitol. He is a overwhelmingly important figure in American history. Kathy, among those forest of hands, one hand went up. Father Sarah, who is essentially the founder of California, has been erased. Another anecdote. I wasn't speaking about World War II. I wasn't speaking about my four uncles who fought in World War II. I wasn't even speaking about the book. But I was on a major college campus just before Christmas. And in the course of my remarks, I mentioned Winston Churchill And the central role that he played in the beginning, the middle, and the successful conclusion of World War II. After I finished, I had several students come up to me and they said, "We've never heard of Winston Churchill."
Oh my goodness.
What a remarkable figure.
Oh my.
Tell us more about this. The memory of a great country. When you seek to change our narrative, when you seek to pull back on facts, fact-based history, and you substitute ideology, mostly progressive ideology, what you end up with is an entire generation of young people who do not understand the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the whole story that made this remarkable country possible.
In reading through your book and the anecdotes you're sharing, it took me back to my college years and probably after college reading The Closing of the American Mind.
Yes, I was just at the University of Chicago.
By Alan Bloom.
Yes.
And I was an example of that, that here I was, I went to had a government degree, I went to a top law school, and I had never had a course called Western Civilization. I didn't have really English classes that really went into the literary classics. And so to think back then, and then how much further we are down the road, or even one of the examples in your book, I thought that in the past, when you talk about your friend Craig, then the early 70s, it would have been My Country, 'Tis of Thee. And then, well, before that, and then it was all of a sudden, If I Had a Hammer.
Yes. Yes. I'm so glad you mentioned this. Two things. I was at the University of Chicago last week at the law school. And had a wonderful roundtable gathering there. And I was speaking to these young, bright, remarkable Americans about what are the ramifications in Chicago. Here we are, one of the elite law schools in our country. And the background is one of our great cities, Chicago. What's happening there? I mean, how is it possible that you can have this enormous amount of public funding spent per student? And yet in the most elemental surveys, the kind of genuine, simple test that's given to people who want to be legal immigrants, that same test given to public school students, right? And you find routinely that less than 20% of students can answer the most basic questions. You know, and I said to myself in writing this book, is it bad teaching? Is it bad parenting? What is the basis of the illiteracy we're talking about? And as you know from the book, Kathy, I came to the conclusion that this was planned, that this was part of progressivism in America in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, to essentially attack the American story, erase our memory, erase our narrative, okay? And to essentially supplant fact-based history, often uncomfortable facts, and to replace it with something new that is ideology and not history. And as the great historian Paul Johnson once famously said, that the antidote to arrogance is good history. You know, we have to be comfortable with there are, you know, imperfect human beings, flawed human beings. But ipso facto, it doesn't mean that because someone is flawed or imperfect, that they are therefore they don't have the potential of greatness. That a country can have flaws. It can have sins. It can have chapters of its history that we wish were not the case. But people of goodwill can say, but it's the United States. This is the country of the United States Constitution. This is the country that led the victory in World War II. This is the country that came through the Civil War, lost 700,000 people, and had a new birth of freedom. I mean, this matters. These are facts.
You mentioned the immigration exam.
Yes.
One bit of good news about the state of Arizona is that when Governor Ducey, his first year in office, had a law passed that high school students in Arizona, in order to graduate in public or charter schools, have to pass 70% citizenship.
Yes.
And there's also requirements that to graduate, you have to have 3 credits in social studies, and that includes American and Arizona history, world history and geography, and also Arizona government civics and economics classes. So, and then even last year, we have 2 of our current state legislators, one Romanian-born, the other Vietnam-born. The Vietnam legislator, Representative Nguyen, was on one of the last planes out of Vietnam. And they got through a law that basically says you also have to talk principles of freedom and compare it to totalitarian and communist governments and all of that, because we see students also don't know that. Well, you know, what's happening in education, you also kind of draw a parallel to how it undermines parents' relationships with their children. So I think parents need to really grasp that as far as what's going on in education and how it interferes with their relationships with their own children.
First, I could not agree more. I said at the beginning of our conversation that I'm an unsinkable optimist. I'm well aware of what former Governor Ducey achieved. The last conversation that I was honored to have with Milton Friedman when he came to the White House was that he felt that in the next chapter, he was in his 90s then, but in the next chapter of his legacy, it was about school choice. It was about charter schools that made school choice possible. And what I'm suggesting by this is that we are living in a time presently of not only parental, but grandparental rebellion. People of a sudden, Kathy, are saying, what's a school board? In toward a more perfect union, that the solution will not come from Washington, D.C. or Silicon Valley or Hollywood or Wall Street, that it will be a local solution. It begins in the home, family, marriage, parenting. It begins in relationships with grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins and nieces and nephews and community that say we want something different. That goes to the school. It goes to the whole idea of history and civics and how they go together. This is the American story. You know, education is now and shall ever be a local and regional issue. There's too much interference and direction from Washington, D.C.
So, and in Arizona, we've made progress in having some quality school board members start to serve and seeing the need to serve. So for the parent who's listening, what would you recommend, say, two or three documents, founding documents, or maybe even planning their summer vacation or their fall break vacation? what historic sites should they take their children to? I mean, just some of those practical suggestions for mom and dad. Here's what you can be doing with your child.
I really love that question, and I write about it at length. You know, it really begins with a spark of imagination with young people. You know, it's very important to take our children to historic sites. Go to Mount Vernon and look at the things that George Washington looked at. Go to Gettysburg. Go to Little Round Top, right? Understand what happened with Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain at Little Round Top as one of the most pivotal moments in American history. You know, you and I are having this wonderful conversation in the great state of Arizona. And I came in a few days ago and I buzzed, you know, upward to the Grand Canyon. I'm a conservative, and Theodore Roosevelt was a progressive. So I'm sure that, you know, even in real time, we would not have agreed on a lot of things. But I think he's one of the great Americans. And he said every American, one time in his or her life, should stand on the south rim of the Grand Canyon and just look. You know, I think young people need to be given time to dream long dreams. And they need to be able to go onto the battlefields. You know, go to Civil War sites, go to American Revolutionary War sites, walk the Freedom Trail in Boston, go to Yosemite. You know, when you look at our incredible national parks, when you look at our Civil War and Revolutionary sites, when you look at the remarkable local and regional history, too often in our digitally distracted ages, young people are spending too much time alone. And they're not going with their parents, their grandparents. They're not going out to the kind of sites and public places that are specifically designed to share the great American story. And by the way, it's not just a cultural, it's a moral story. You know, it's impossible to understand the United States apart from religious liberty and from conscience. And I would say that without the Judeo and Christian traditions, we would not be the United States of America. And if we lose the Constitution, it seems to me we'll never get it back.
Well, and let's talk about the Constitution, because you talk about the perils of Constitution ignorance. And, you know, I love this comment that you in the book that you said that politicians treat the Constitution as sort of a legal Santa Claus. It can be made to grant their wishes if they wear it down with pestering. And, you know, an example of that in Arizona, every year now, we have the left wants to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment to the United States Constitution. There is no process, there is no legal way that the ratification of that amendment was over many, many years ago. But somehow they think that they can change the Constitution and bring it back. But talk about, you know, people who don't know the Constitution and what the ramifications that you see on that.
You know, when I go to the National Archives, which I do once a year, and stand and look at the Constitution, you realize that it's really only four pages. You know, it's not some document that's 5,000 pages, kind of like Gone with the Wind. You know, it was designed to be written in elegant but rather simple English, and it was designed to be widely read by the literate American population of the 18th century. It has a fixed meaning. There is no such thing as the living Constitution. For those who don't know, the living Constitution is a kind of blithe phrase that means that it changes with style and fashion and fad. That is decidedly not the case. Words have meanings. Meanings are fixed and have a reason and a purpose. And why is that? Because it has the force of law. And so it seems to me that the most important public service that any parent or grandparent could do, I mean, number one, is to read the Constitution with their children or grandchildren. And then after having read it, discuss it. The same with the Declaration of Independence. I must tell you, I have lived in the Commonwealth of Virginia for 35 years. And one of the things that my wife and I and our sons love to do, is to go to historic places. We've gone to the James Madison ancestral home. We've gone to Thomas Jefferson's ancestral home, which have now, as you may have read or known, has been partially overtaken by progressives who want to fundamentally change who James Madison was, who Thomas Jefferson was. I mean, the primary architects and author of our Constitution and of our Declaration.
You also, when you earlier you talked about the data, and when we talk about the Constitution, the statistic that you had about how few people could name a right in the First Amendment, because in the right to believe, when you mentioned religious liberty, that is so much what we are having to defend now in ways that we never thought we would have.
Yes.
But the lack of understanding of the First Amendment freedoms is, would you say, one of the most critical issues that we face today?
I could not agree more. And again, I'm a Lincoln man, so he was a Euclidean. It's not enough for me to just assert, I have to demonstrate. You know, in my role as one of the vice presidents at Focus on the Family, I spend a lot of time with the political class, both parties, every ideology, et cetera. And back to David McCullough for just one moment. You know, Kathy, people of goodwill, bright people, smart people, people who are, you know, genuinely publicly minded from both political parties. But you'll make a basic assertion about the Constitution. About the Third or Fourth or Fifth Amendment, or the application of the 14th Amendment, which is very important now among those of us who are conservatives. And it's always very sobering to be with a duly elected member of the House or Senate, all shall go unnamed, who are really a little uncertain about what you're talking about, you know?
And don't know the three branches of government.
May I say, in the book, you'll find data. I don't overwhelm people with data, but I wanted them to be able to look and see for themselves what people in our country presently know about the kind of things we're talking about. And as I said earlier, it's a bit sobering to realize that if any of us have had these moments where we will make a very basic historic or cultural or public policy reference that we rightly assume everybody understands, and you realize very quickly that not everybody understands. And it's most concerning when the people who have been voted to represent us, right? That's the great architecture of a constitutional republic, that they do not know what you're talking about. It's something that I think we have to internalize, we have to absorb, and above all, as Christians and as conservatives, we have to say, what can we do about it? Because it seems to me that the most important question now in public life is the following. What kind of a country do we want 50 years from now? You know, there was a time not very long ago, this is not nostalgia, this is not sentiment. There was a time not long ago where our parents, our grandparents, their generations before them, there was a basic assumption. The Constitution's in place, the country goes on. But as we know from history, in eras of spiritual recession, in eras where religion and faith are necessarily by the lights of too many people who are anti-faith and anti-religion, as they place our faith, away from the public square, what happens is mass secularization and, frankly, a kind of incivility that ultimately can destroy freedom. Because the great genius in the American experience is the following, that if you want liberty and freedom over time, you have to have virtue in the people. Virtue is the other side of freedom. Virtue is a nice word, it's a fancy word, it's moral excellence. We have to inculcate, we have to nourish virtue, moral excellence in the leaders and in the people. And part of being virtuous is not just habituating people to good behavior, but it is modeling it from a very young age in the people whom we elect to serve us. Because the center of the project is we the people. And our founders knew that there was a moment in history where a relatively free Roman Republic became a Roman Empire, where people in a republic who were citizens under an empire became subjects. And I fear, Kathy, that with the kind of cultural and historic and constitutional illiteracy that we've been discussing, that freedom is lost incrementally. And of a sudden, people wake up and they think to themselves, I feel more like a subject and I feel less like a citizen. When did that happen?
Two impediments potentially to what you're talking about. The first one, you've talked about this a little bit, but how do we convince a society that is hostile to God? that that he is actually the answer. Mm. I mean, you know, we see some signs of revival, but when we know that we are so, I don't necessarily want to say a postmodern or whatever term you want to give to it, but how do we deal directly with the lack of belief in God?
You know, I think there are excellent models. And one of my favorite models, which I don't write about at length in the book, but which is absolutely the case, is the Victorians. You know, when Victorian England really commenced, they found themselves at a very licentious moment in British history. I mean, things on a social and cultural basis were really heading toward collapse. And the largest question for the early Victorians is, how do you reassert the centrality of religion and faith in the public square? And I'm very happy to say that the great Victorians emerged, the great religious figures, not just those who were formerly in the clergy, but a remarkable number of public men and women, people in literature, people in the arts, people in the humanities, who were broadly committed to religious revival. And of course, many of the great Christian traditions are born really in the Victorian period. And the net result was more and not less marriage, less alcoholism, et cetera, et cetera. So revival and renewal can happen in a country, but it cannot happen, in my view, apart from the centrality of faith. It's not going to be broad humanitarianism. It's not going to be broad altruism. Those things, it seems to me, authentically, when it comes to genuine restoration, are born of Christianity. They are born of an authentic faith where large numbers of people come to see that they can genuinely know God and to love him forever, that they can actually live their faith freely in the public square, they can share the gospel, and they do not have to fear that in some manner they're going to be winnowed or restricted. And that kind of soft authoritarianism actually is real in history. And it's something that I think we have to be very sobering about.
My guest today has been Tim Gagelin with his new book is Toward a More Perfect Union, The Moral and Cultural Case for Teaching the Great American Story. To sum up our discussion, know history, know the path forward.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that we are definitively, in the United States, a religious republic. We're not a theocracy, but you cannot understand our constitutional republic apart from our faith. And so I think, as the great late Michael Novak said, it's two wings. And I believe that virtue and liberty do go together. And I think the great days are ahead of us for the United States of America. I believe that with all my heart.
So again, Tim Gagelin, right now, go to Amazon, go to your favorite bookseller, order. You're going to want to order multiple copies and give them out for those who yearn to know what can we do besides pray and move our country forward. Go get Toward a More Perfect Union by Tim Gagelin. It'll be worth it. And make sure you are working with your family members, your loved ones, those in your circles of influence to point the way and to make sure that we know our history and our constitutional principles. So thank you, Tim, so much for spending time with us on Engage Arizona.
A real joy. Thank you, Kathy. Be of good cheer.
Thank you.
God bless.